Hachette Audio presents The Reversal. Written by Michael Connelly. Read by Peter Giles. Dedication to Dennis Wojciechowski, with many thanks. Part 1. The Perp Walk. Chapter 1. Tuesday, February 9th, 1:43 p.m. The last time I'd eaten at the Water Grill, I sat across the table from a client who had coldly and calculatedly murdered his wife and her lover, shooting both of them in the face. He had engaged my services to not only defend him at trial, but to fully exonerate him and restore his good name in the public eye. This time, I was sitting with someone with whom I needed to be even more careful. I was dining with Gabriel Williams, the district attorney of Los Angeles County. It was a crisp afternoon in midwinter. I sat with Williams and his trusted chief of staff, Reed political advisor, Joe Riddle. The meal had been set for 1:30 p.m., when most courthouse lawyers would be safely back in the CCB and the DA would not be advertising his dalliance with a member of the dark side. Meaning me, Mickey Haller, defender of the damned. The Water Grill was a nice place for a downtown lunch. Good food and atmosphere, good separation between tables for private conversation, and a wine list hard to top in all of downtown. It was the kind of place where you kept your suit jacket on, and the waiter put a black napkin across your lap so you needn't be bothered with doing it yourself. The prosecution team ordered martinis at the county taxpayer's expense, and I stuck with the free water the restaurant was pouring. It took Williams 2 gulps of gin and 1 olive before he got to the reason we were hiding in plain sight. "Mickey, I have a proposition for you." I nodded. Riddle had already said as much when he had called that morning to set up the lunch. I had agreed to the meet and then had gone to work on the phone myself, trying to gather any inside information I could on what the proposition would be. Not even my first ex-wife, who worked in the district attorney's employ, knew what was up. "I'm all ears," I said. "It's not every day that the DA himself wants to give you a proposition. I know it can't be in regard to any of my clients. They wouldn't merit much attention from the guy at the top. And at the moment, I'm only carrying a few cases anyway. Times are slow." "Well, you're right," Williams said. "This is not about any of your clients. I have a case I would like you to take on." I nodded again. I understood now. They all hate the defense attorney until they need the defense attorney. I didn't know if Williams had any children, but he would have known through due diligence that I didn't do juvie work, so I was guessing it had to be his wife. Probably a shoplifting grab or a DUI he was trying to keep under wraps. "Who got popped?" I asked. Williams looked at Riddle, and they shared a smile. "No, nothing like that," Williams said. "My proposition is this. I would like to hire you, Mickey. I want you to come work at the DA's office." Of all the ideas that have been rattling around in my head since I had taken Riddle's call, being hired as a prosecutor wasn't one of them. I'd been a card-carrying member of the criminal defense bar for more than 20 years. During that time, I'd grown a suspicion and distrust of prosecutors and police that might not have equaled that of the gangbangers down in Nickerson Gardens, but was at least at a level that would seem to exclude me from ever joining their ranks. Plain and simple, they wouldn't want me, and I wouldn't want them. Except for that ex-wife I mentioned and a half-brother who was an LAPD detective, I wouldn't turn my back on any of them, especially Williams. He was a politician first and a prosecutor second. That made him even more dangerous. Though briefly a prosecutor early in his legal career, he spent 2 decades as a civil rights attorney before running for the DA post as an outsider and riding into office on a tide of anti-police and prosecutor sentiment. I was employing full caution at the fancy lunch from the moment the napkin went across my lap. "Work for you?" I asked. "Doing what exactly?" "As a special prosecutor. A one-time deal. I want you to handle the Jason Jessup case." I looked at him for a long moment. First, I thought I would laugh out loud. This was some sort of cleverly orchestrated joke. But then I understood that couldn't be the case. They don't take you out to the water grill just to make a joke. You want me to prosecute Jessup? From what I hear, there's nothing to prosecute. That case is a duck without wings. The only thing left to do is shoot it and eat it. Williams shook his head in a manner that seemed intended to convince himself of something, not me. Next Tuesday is the anniversary of the murder, he said. I'm going to announce that we intend to retry Jessup, and I would like you standing next to me at the press conference. I leaned back in my seat and looked at them. I've spent a good part of my adult life looking across courtrooms and trying to read juries, judges, witnesses, and prosecutors. I think I've gotten pretty good at it. But at that table, I couldn't read Williams or his sidekick sitting 3 feet away from me. Jason Jessup was a convicted child killer who had spent nearly 24 years in prison until a month earlier when the California Supreme Court reversed his conviction and sent the case back to Los Angeles County for either retrial or a dismissal of the charges. The reversal came after a two-decade-long legal battle staged primarily from Jessup's cell and with his own pen. Authoring appeals, motions, complaints, and whatever legal challenges he could research, the self-styled lawyer made no headway with state and federal courts, but did finally win the attention of an organization of lawyers known as the Genetic Justice Project. They took over his cause and his case, and eventually won an order for genetic testing of semen found on the dress of the child Jessup had been convicted of strangling. Jessup had been convicted before DNA analysis was used in criminal trials. The analysis performed these many years later determined that the semen found on the dress had not come from Jessup, but from another unknown individual. Though the courts had repeatedly upheld Jessup's conviction, this new information tipped the scales in Jessup's favor. The state's Supreme Court cited the DNA findings and other inconsistencies in the evidence and trial record and reversed the case. This was pretty much the extent of my knowledge of the Jessup case, and it was largely information gathered from newspaper stories and courthouse scuttlebutt. While I had not read the court's complete order, I had read parts of it in the Los Angeles Times and knew it was a blistering decision that echoed many of Jessup's long-held claims of innocence, as well as police and prosecutorial misconduct in the case. As a defense attorney, I can't say I wasn't pleased to see the DA's office raked over the media coals with the ruling. Call it underdog schadenfreude. It didn't really matter that it wasn't my case, or that the current regime in the DA's office had nothing to do with the case back in 1986. There are so few victories from the defense side of the bar that there is always a sense of communal joy in the success of others and the defeat of the establishment. The Supreme Court's ruling was announced the week before, starting a 60-day clock during which the DA would have to retry or discharge Jessup. It seemed that not a day had gone by since the ruling that Jessup was not in the news. He gave multiple interviews by phone and in person at San Quentin, proclaiming his innocence and pot-shotting the police and prosecutors who put him there. In his plight, he had garnered the support of several Hollywood celebrities and professional athletes and had already launched a civil claim against both the city and county, seeking millions of dollars in damages for the many long years during which he was falsely incarcerated. In this day of non-stop media cycles, he had a never-ending forum and was using it to elevate himself to folk hero status. When he finally walked out of prison, he too would be a celebrity. Knowing as little as I did about the case and the details, I was of the impression that he was an innocent man who had been subjected to a quarter century of torture and that he deserved whatever he could get for it. I did, however, know enough about the case to understand that with the DNA evidence cutting Jessup's way, the case was a loser, and the idea of retrying Jessup seemed to be an exercise in political masochism, unlikely to come from the brain trust of Williams and Riddle. Unless... What do you know that I don't know? I asked. And that the Los Angeles Times doesn't know? Williams smiled smugly and leaned forward across the table to deliver his answer. All Jessup established with the help of the GJP is that his DNA was not on the victim's dress, he said. As the petitioner, it was not up to him to establish who it did come from. So you ran it through the databanks? Williams nodded. We did, and we got a hit. He offered nothing else. Well, who was it? I'm not going to reveal that to you unless you come on board the case. Otherwise, I need to keep it confidential. But I will say that I believe our findings lead to a trial tactic that could neutralize the DNA question, leaving the rest of the case and the evidence pretty much intact. DNA was not needed to convict him the first time. We won't need it now. As in 1986, we believe Jessup is guilty of this crime, and I would be delinquent in my duties if I did not attempt to prosecute him, no matter the chances of conviction, the potential political fallout, and the public perception of the case. Spoken as if you were looking at the cameras and not at me. Then why don't you prosecute him? I asked. Why come to me? You have 300 able lawyers working for you. I can think of one you've got stuck up in the Van Nuys office who would take this case in a heartbeat. Why come to me? Because this prosecution can't come from within the DA's office. I'm sure you have read or heard the allegations. There's a taint on this case, and it doesn't matter that there isn't one goddamn lawyer working for me who was around back then. I still need to bring in an outsider, an independent, to take it to court. Somebody... That's what the Attorney General's office is for, I said. You need an independent counsel. You go to him. Now I was just poking him in the eye, and everybody at the table knew it. There was no way Gabriel Williams was going to ask the state AG to come in on the case. That would cross the razor wire line of politics. The AG post was an elected office in California and was seen by every political pundit in town as Williams' next stop on his way to the governor's mansion or some other lofty political plateau. The last thing Williams would be willing to do was hand a potential political rival a case that could be used against him, no matter how old it was. In politics, in the courtroom, in life, you don't give your opponent the club with which he can turn around and clobber you. We're not going to the AG with this one, Williams said in a matter-of-fact manner. That's why I want you, Mickey. You're a well-known and respected criminal defense attorney. I think the public will trust you to be independent in this matter and will therefore trust and accept the conviction you'll win in this case. While I was staring at Williams, a waiter came to the table to take our order. Without ever breaking eye contact with me, Williams told him to go away. I haven't been paying a lot of attention to this, I said. Who's Jessup's defense attorney? I would find it difficult to go up against a colleague I know well. Right now, all he's got is his GJP lawyer and his civil litigator. He hasn't hired defense counsel because, quite frankly, he's expecting us to drop this whole thing. I nodded, another hurdle cleared for the moment. But he's got a surprise coming, Williams said. We're going to bring him down here and retry him. He did it, Mickey, and that's all you really need to know. There's a little girl who's still dead, and that's all any prosecutor needs to know. Take the case. Do something for your community and for yourself. Who knows? You might even like it and want to stay on. If so, we'll definitely entertain the possibility. I dropped my eyes to the linen tablecloth and thought about his last words. For a moment, I involuntarily conjured the image of my daughter sitting in a courtroom and watching me stand for the people instead of the accused. Williams kept talking, unaware that I had already come to a decision. Obviously, I can't pay you your rate, but if you take this on, I don't think you'll be doing it for the money anyway. I can give you an office and a secretary, and I can give you whatever science and forensics you need. The very best of every... I don't want an office in the DA's office. I would need to be independent of that. I have to be completely autonomous. No more lunches. We make the announcement and then you leave me alone. I decide how to proceed with the case. Fine. Use your own office, just as long as you don't store evidence there. And of course you make your own decisions. And if I do this, I pick second chair and my own investigator out of the LAPD, people I can trust. In or outside my office for your second? I would need someone inside. Then I assume we're talking about your ex-wife. That's right, if she'll take it. And if somehow we get a conviction out of this thing, you pull her out of Van Nuys and put her downtown in major crimes where she belongs. That's easier said than that's the deal. Take it or leave it. Williams glanced at Riddle, and I saw the supposed sidekick give an almost imperceptible nod of approval. "All right," William said, turning back to me. "Then I guess I'll take it. You win, and she's in. We have a deal." He reached his hand across the table, and I shook it. He smiled, but I didn't. "Mickey Haller, for the people," he said. "Has a nice ring to it. For the people." It should have made me feel good. It should have made me feel like I was part of something that was noble and right. But all I had was the bad feeling that I had crossed some sort of line within myself. "Wonderful," I said. Chapter 2. Friday, February 12th, 10 a.m. Harry Bosch stepped up to the front counter of the district attorney's office on the 18th floor of the criminal courts building. He gave his name and said he had a 10 a.m. appointment with District Attorney Gabriel Williams.
"Actually, your meeting is in Conference Room A," said the receptionist after checking a computer screen in front of her. "You go through the door, turn right, and go to the end of the hall. Right again, and Conference Room A is on the left. It's marked on the door. They're expecting you."
The door in the paneled wood wall behind her buzzed free, and Bosch went through, wondering about the fact that they were waiting for him. Since he had received the summons from the DA's secretary the afternoon before, Bosch had been unable to determine what it was about. Secrecy was expected from the DA's office, but usually some information trickled out. He hadn't even known he would be meeting with more than one person until now. Following the prescribed trail, Bosch came to the door marked Conference Room A, knocked once, and heard a female voice say, "Come in." He entered and saw a woman seated by herself at an 8-chaired table, a spread of documents, files, photos, and a laptop computer in front of her. She looked vaguely familiar, but he could not place her. She was attractive, with dark, curling hair framing her face. She had sharp eyes that followed him as he entered, and a pleasant, almost curious smile, like she knew something he didn't. She wore the standard female prosecutor's power suit in navy blue. Harry might not have been able to place her, but he assumed she was a DDA.
"Detective Bosch?"
"That's me."
"Come in, have a seat."
Bosch pulled out a chair and sat across from her. On the table, he saw a crime scene photograph of a child's body in an open dumpster. It was a girl, and she was wearing a blue dress with long sleeves. Her feet were bare, and she was lying on a pile of construction debris and other trash. The white edges of the photo were yellowed. It was an old print. The woman moved a file over the picture and then offered her hand across the table.
"I don't think we've ever met," she said. "My name is Maggie McPherson."
Bosch recognized the name, but he couldn't remember from where or what case.
"I'm a deputy district attorney," she continued, "and I'm going to be second chair on the Jason Jessup prosecution."
"First chair, Jason Jessup?" Bosch asked. "You're going to take it to trial?"
"Yes, we are. We'll be announcing it next week, and I need to ask you to keep it confidential until then. I am sorry that our first chair is late coming to our meet."
The door opened, and Bosch turned. Mickey Haller stepped into the room. Bosch did a double take, not because he didn't recognize Haller. They were half-brothers, and he easily knew him on sight. But seeing Haller in the DA's office was one of those images that didn't quite make sense. Haller was a criminal defense attorney. He fit in at the DA's office about as well as a cat did at the dog pound. "I know," Haller said. "You're thinking, what in the hell is this?" Smiling, Haller moved to McPherson's side of the table and started pulling out a chair. Then Bosch remembered how he knew McPherson's name. "You two," Bosch said. "You were married, right?"
"That's right," Haller said. 8 wonderful years."
"And what, she's prosecuting Jessup and you're defending him? Isn't that a conflict of interest?"
Haller's smile became a broad grin.
"It would only be a conflict if we were opposing each other, Harry. But we're not. We're prosecuting him. Together. I'm first chair, Maggie's second, and we want you to be our investigator."
Bosch was completely confused.
"Wait a minute. You're not a prosecutor. This doesn't..."
"I'm an appointed independent prosecutor, Harry. It's all legit. I wouldn't be sitting here if it weren't. We're going after Jessup, and we want you to help us."
Bosch pulled out a chair and slowly sat down. From what I heard, this case is beyond help. Unless you're telling me Jessup rigged the DNA test.
No, we're not telling you that, McPherson said. We did our own testing and matching. His results were correct. It wasn't his DNA on the victim's dress.
But that doesn't mean we've lost the case, Holler quickly added. Bosch looked from McPherson to Holler and then back again. He was clearly missing something. Then whose DNA was it? He asked. McPherson glanced sideways at Holler before answering.
Her stepfather's, she said. He's dead now, but we believe there is an explanation for why his semen was found on his stepdaughter's dress.
Holler leaned urgently across the table. An explanation that still leaves room to reconvict Jessup of the girl's murder. Bosch thought for a moment, and the image of his own daughter flashed in his mind. He knew there were certain kinds of evil in the world that had to be contained, no matter the hardship. A child killer was at the top of that list. Okay, he said. I'm in. Chapter 3. Tuesday, February 16th, 1 p.m. The DA's office had a press conference room that had not been updated since the days they'd used it to hold briefings on the Charles Manson case. Its faded wood-paneled walls and drooping flags in the corner had been the backdrop of 1,000 press briefings, and they gave all proceedings there a threadbare appearance that belied the true power and might of the office. The state prosecutor was never the underdog in any undertaking, yet it appeared that the office did not have the money for even a fresh coat of paint. The setting, however, served the announcement on the Jessup decision well. For possibly the first time in these hallowed halls of justice, the prosecution would indeed be the underdog. The decision to retry Jason Jessup was fraught with peril and the realistic likelihood of failure. As I stood at the front of the room, next to Gabriel Williams and before a phalanx of video cameras, bright lights, and reporters, it finally dawned on me what a terrible mistake I had made. My decision to take on the case in hopes of currying favor with my daughter, ex-wife, and myself was going to be met with disastrous consequences. I was going to go down in flames. It was a rare moment to witness firsthand. The media had gathered to report the end of the story. The DA's office would assuredly announce that Jason Jessup would not be subjected to a retrial. The DA might not offer an apology, but would at the very least say the evidence was not there, that there was no case against this man who had been incarcerated for so long. The case would be closed, and in the eyes of the law as well as the public, Jessup would finally be a free and innocent man. The media is rarely fooled in complete numbers, and usually doesn't react well when it happens. But there was no doubt that Williams had punked them all. We had moved stealthily in the last week, putting together the team and reviewing the evidence that was still available. Not a word had leaked, which must have been a first in the halls of the CCB. While I could see the first inkling of suspicion creasing the brows of the reporters who recognized me as we entered, it was Williams who delivered the knockout punch when he wasted no time in stepping before a lectern festooned with microphones and digital recorders. On a Sunday morning, 24 years ago today, 12-year-old Melissa Landy was taken from her yard in Hancock Park and brutally murdered. An investigation quickly led to a suspect named Jason Jessup. He was arrested, convicted at trial, and sentenced to life in prison without parole. That conviction was reversed 2 weeks ago by the state Supreme Court and remanded to my office. I am here to announce that the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office will retry Jason Jessup in the death of Melissa Landy. The charges of abduction and murder stand. This office intends once again to prosecute Mr. Jessup to the fullest extent of the law. He paused to add appropriate gravity to the announcement. As you know, the Supreme Court found that irregularities occurred during the first prosecution, which, of course, occurred more than 2 decades before the current administration. To avoid political conflicts and any future appearance of impropriety on the part of this office, I have appointed an independent special prosecutor to handle the case. Many of you know of the man standing here to my right.
Michael Haller has been a defense counsel of some note in Los Angeles for 2 decades. He is a fair-minded and respected member of the bar. He has accepted the appointment and has assumed responsibility for the case as of today. It has been the policy of this department not to try cases in the media. However, Mr. Haller and I are willing to answer a few questions as long as they don't tread on the specifics and evidence of the case. There was a booming chorus of voices calling questions out at us. Williams raised his hands for calm in the room. One at a time, people. Let's start with you. He pointed to a woman sitting in the first row. I could not remember her name, but I knew she worked for the Times. Williams knew his priorities. Kate Salters from the Times, she said helpfully. Can you tell us how you came to the decision to prosecute Jason Jessup again after DNA evidence cleared him of the crime? Before coming into the room, Williams had told me that he would handle the announcement and all questions, unless specifically addressed to me. He made it clear that this was going to be his show, but I decided to make it clear from the outset that it was going to be my case. I'll answer that, I said, as I leaned toward the lectern and the microphones. The DNA test conducted by the Genetic Justice Project only concluded that the bodily fluid found on the victim's clothing did not come from Jason Jessup. It did not clear him of involvement in the crime. There is a difference. The DNA test only provides additional information for a jury to consider. I straightened back up and caught Williams giving me a don't fuck with me stare. Whose DNA was it? Someone called out. Williams quickly leaned forward to answer. We're not answering questions about evidence at this time. Mickey, why are you taking the case? The question came from the back of the room, from behind the lights, and I could not see the owner of the voice. I moved back to the microphones, angling my body so Williams had to step back. Good question, I said. It's certainly unusual for me to be on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, but I think this is the case to cross over for. I'm an officer of the court and a proud member of the California Bar. We take an oath to seek justice and fairness while upholding the Constitution and laws of this nation and state. One of the duties of a lawyer is to take a just cause without personal consideration to himself. This is such a cause. Someone has to speak for Melissa Landy. I have reviewed the evidence in this case, and I think I'm on the right side of this one. The measure is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that such proof exists here. Williams moved in and put a hand on my arm to gently move me off the microphone stand. We do not want to go any further than that in regard to the evidence, he said quickly. Jessup's already spent 24 years in prison, Salters said. Anything less than a conviction for first-degree murder, and he will probably walk on time served. Mr. Williams, is it really worth the expense and effort of retrying this man? Before she was finished asking the question, I knew she and Williams had a deal working. She lobbed softballs and he hit them out of the park, looking good and righteous on the 11 o'clock news and in the morning paper. Her end of the deal would come with inside scoops on the evidence and trial strategy. I decided in that moment that it was my case, my trial, my deal. None of that matters, I said loudly from my position to the side. All eyes turned to me. Even Williams turned. Can you talk into the microphones, Mickey? It was the same voice from behind the line of lights. He knew to call me Mickey. I once again moved to the microphones, boxing Williams out like a power forward going for the rebound. The murder of a child is a crime that must be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, no matter what the possibilities or risks are. There is no guarantee of victory here. But that was not part of the decision. The measure is reasonable doubt, and I believe we surpass that. We believe that the totality of evidence shows that this man committed this horrible crime, and it doesn't matter how much time has gone by or how long he has been incarcerated. He must be prosecuted. I have a daughter, only a little older than Melissa was. You know, people forget that in the original trial, the state sought the death penalty, but the jury recommended against it, and the judge imposed a life sentence. That was then, and this is now. We will once again be seeking the death penalty on this case. Williams put his hand on my shoulder and pulled me away from the microphones. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here, he said quickly. My office has not yet made a determination in regard to whether we will be seeking the death penalty. That will come at a later time. But Mr. Haller makes a very valid and sad point. There can be no worse crime in our society than the murder of a child. We must do all that is within our power and our reach to seek justice for Melissa Landy. Thank you for being here today. Wait a minute, called a reporter from one of the middle seats. What about Jessup? When will he be brought here for trial? Williams put his hands on both sides of the lectern in a casual move designed to keep me from the microphones. Earlier this morning, Mr. Jessup was taken into custody by the Los Angeles police and is being transported from San Quentin. He will be booked into the downtown jail and the case will proceed. His conviction was reversed, but the charges against him remain in place. We have nothing further at this time. William stepped back and signaled me toward the door. He waited until I started moving and was clear of the microphones. He then followed, coming up behind me and whispering into my ear as we went through the door. You do that again and I'll fire you on the spot. I turned to look back at him while I walked. Do what? Answer one of your setup questions? We moved into the hallway. Riddle was waiting there with the office's media spokesman, a guy named Fernandez. But Williams turned me down the hall away from them. He was still whispering when he spoke. You went off the script. Do it again, and we're done. I stopped and turned, and Williams almost walked into me. Look, I'm not your puppet, I said. I'm an independent contractor, remember? You treat me otherwise, and you're going to be holding this hot potato without an oven mitt. Williams just glared at me. I obviously wasn't getting through. And what was this shit about the death penalty? He asked. We haven't even gotten there, and you didn't have the go-ahead to say it. He was bigger than me, taller. He had used his body to crowd my space and back me up against the wall. It will get back to Jessup and keep him thinking, I said. And if we're lucky, he comes in for a deal and this whole thing goes away, including the civil action. It'll save you all that money. That's really what this is about, right? The money? We get a conviction and he's got no civil case. You and the city save a few million bucks. That's got nothing to do with this. This is about justice, and you still should have told me what you were doing. You don't sandbag your own boss. The physical intimidation got old real fast. I put my palm on his chest and backed him off me. Yeah, well, you're not my boss. I don't have a boss. Is that right? Like I said, I could fire your ass right here, right now. I pointed down the hall to the door to the press conference room. Yeah, that'll look good. Firing the independent prosecutor you just hired. Didn't Nixon do that during the Watergate mess? Worked real well for him. Why don't we go back in and tell them? I'm sure there are still a few cameras in there. Williams hesitated, realizing his predicament. I had backed him against the wall without even moving. He would look like a complete and unelectable fool if he fired me, and he knew it. He leaned in closer, and his whisper dropped lower as he used the oldest threat in the mano a mano handbook. I was ready for it. Do not fuck with me, Haller. Then don't fuck with my case. This isn't a campaign stop, and it's not about money. This is murder, boss. You want me to get a conviction? Then get out of my way. I threw him the bone of calling him boss. Williams pressed his mouth into a tight line and stared at me for a long moment. Just so we understand each other, he finally said. I nodded. Yeah, I think we do. Before you talk to the media about this case, you get it approved by my office first. Understand? Got it. He turned and headed down the hall. His entourage followed. I remained in the hallway and watched them go. The truth was, there was nothing in the law that I objected to more than the death penalty. It was not that I had ever had a client executed or even tried such a case. It was simply a belief in the idea that an enlightened society did not kill its own. But somehow, that didn't stop me from using the threat of the death penalty as an edge in the case. As I stood there alone in the hallway, I thought that maybe that made me a better prosecutor than I had imagined I could be.
Chapter 4. Tuesday, February 16th, 2:43 p.m. It was usually the best moment of a case. The drive downtown with a suspect handcuffed in the back seat. There was nothing better. Sure, there was the eventual payoff of a conviction down the line. Being in the courtroom when the verdict is read, watching the reality shock and then deaden the eyes of the convicted. But the drive in was always better, more immediate and personal. It was always the moment Bosch savored. The chase was over, and the case was about to morph from the relentless momentum of the investigation to the measured pace of the prosecution. But this time was different. It had been a long 2 days, and Bosch wasn't savoring anything. He and his partner, David Chu, had driven up the day before, checking into a motel off the 101 and spending the night. In the morning, they drove over to San Quentin, presented a court order that transferred custody of Jason Jessup to them, and then collected their prisoner for the drive back to Los Angeles. 7 hours each way, with a partner who talked too much. 7 hours on the return with a suspect who didn't talk enough. They were now at the top of the San Fernando Valley and an hour from the city jail in downtown L.A. Bosch's back hurt from so many hours behind the wheel. His right calf muscle ached from applying pressure to the gas pedal. The city car did not have cruise control. Chu had offered to drive, but Bosch had said no. Chu religiously stuck to the speed limit, even on the freeway. Bosch would take the backache over an extra hour on the freeway and the anxiety it would create. All of this aside, he drove in uneasy silence, brooding about a case that seemed to be proceeding backwards. He had been on it for only a few days, hadn't had the opportunity to even become acquainted with all the facts, and here he was with the suspect hooked up and in the back seat. To Bosch, it felt like the arrest was coming first, and the investigation wouldn't really start until after Jessup was booked. He checked his watch and knew the scheduled press conference must be over by now. The plan was for him to meet with Holler and McPherson at 4 to continue kicking around the case. But by the time Jessup was booked, he would be late. He also needed to go by LAPD archives to pick up 2 boxes that were waiting for him. "Perry, what's wrong?" Bosch glanced at Chu. "Nothing's wrong." He wasn't going to talk in front of the suspect. Besides, he and Chu had been partnered for less than a year. It was a little soon for Chu to be making reads off of Bosch's demeanor. Harry didn't want him to know that he had accurately deduced that he was uncomfortable. Jessup spoke from the back seat, his first words since asking for a bathroom break outside of Stockton. "What's wrong is that he doesn't have a case. What's wrong is that he knows this whole thing is bullshit, and he doesn't want to be a part of it." Bosch checked Jessup in the rearview mirror. He was slightly hunched forward because his hands were cuffed and locked to a chain that went to a set of shackles around his ankles. His head was shaved, a routine prison practice among men hoping to intimidate others. Bosch guessed that with Jessup, it had probably worked.
"I thought you didn't want to talk, Jessup. You invoked."
"Yeah, that's right. I'll just shut the fuck up and wait for my lawyer."
"He's in San Francisco. I wouldn't hold my breath."
"He's calling somebody. The GJP's got people all over the country. We were ready for this."
"Really? You were ready? You mean you packed your cell up because you thought you were being transferred? Or was it because you thought you were going home?"
Jessup didn't have an answer for that one. Bosch merged onto the 101, which would take them through the Cahuenga Pass and into Hollywood before they reached downtown.
"How'd you get hooked up with a genetic justice project, Jessup?" he asked, trying once again to get something going. "You go to them, or they come to you?"
"Website, man. I sent in my appeal, and they saw the bullshit going on in my case. They took it over, and here I am. You people are totally fucked if you think you're gonna win this. I was railroaded by you motherfuckers once before. Ain't gonna happen again. In 2 months, this'll all be over. I've been in 24 years. What's 2 more months? Just makes my book rights more valuable. I guess I should be thanking you and the district attorney for that."
Bosch glanced at the mirror again. Normally, he would love a talkative suspect.
Most times they talked themselves right into prison. But Jessup was too smart and too cagey. He chose his words carefully, stayed away from talking about the crime itself, and wouldn't be making a mistake that Bosch could use. In the mirror now, Bosch could see Jessup staring out the window. No telling what he was thinking about. His eyes looked dead. Bosch could see the top of a prison ink tattoo on his neck, just breaking the collar line. It looked like part of a word, but he couldn't tell for sure. "Welcome to L.A., Jessup," Chu said without turning around. "Guess it's been a while, huh?" "Fuck you, you chink motherfucker," Jessup retorted. "This'll all be over soon, and then I'll be out and on the beach. I'm gonna get a longboard and ride some tasty waves."
"Don't count on it, killer," Chu said. "You're going down. We got you by the balls."
Bosch knew Chu was trying to provoke a response, a slip of the tongue, but he was coming off as an amateur, and Jessup was too wise for him. Harry grew tired of the back and forth, even after 6 hours of almost complete silence. He turned on the car's radio and caught the tail end of a report on the DA's press conference. He turned it up so Jessup would hear, and Chu would keep quiet. Williams and Haller refused to comment on the evidence, but indicated they were not as impressed with the DNA analysis as the state Supreme Court was. Haller acknowledged that the DNA found on the victim's dress did not come from Jessup, but he said the findings did not clear him of involvement in the crime. Haller is a well-known defense attorney and will be prosecuting a murder case for the first time. It did not sound this morning as though he has any hesitation. "We will once again be seeking the death penalty on this case." Bosch flicked the volume down and checked the mirror. Jessup was still looking out the window.
"How about that, Jessup? He's going for the Jesus juice."
Jessup responded tirelessly. "Assholes posturing. Besides, they don't execute anybody in this state anymore. You know what death row means? Means you get a cell all to yourself and you control what's on the TV. It means better access to phone, food, and visitors. Fuck it, I hope he does go for it, man. But it won't matter. This is bullshit. This whole thing is bullshit. It's all about the money." The last line floated out there for a long moment before Bosch finally bit.
"What money?"
"My money. You watch, man. They'll come at me with a deal. My lawyer told me they'll want me to take a deal and plead to time served so they don't have to pay me the money. That's all this fucking is, and you two are just the delivery men. Fucking FedEx." Bosch was silent. He wondered if it could be true. Jessup was suing the city and county for millions. Could it be that the retrial was simply a political move designed to save money? Both government entities were self-insured. Juries loved hitting faceless corporations and bureaucracies with obscenely large judgments. A jury believing prosecutors and police had corruptly imprisoned an innocent man for 24 years would be beyond generous. A hit from an eight-figure judgment could be devastating to both city and county coffers, even if they were splitting the bill. But if they jammed Jessup and maneuvered him into a deal in which he acknowledged guilt to gain his freedom, then the lawsuit would go away. So would all the book and movie money he was counting on.
"Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?" Jessup said.
Bosch checked the mirror and realized that now Jessup was studying him. He turned his eyes back to the road. He felt his phone vibrate and pulled it out of his jacket.
"You want me to take it, Harry?" Chu asked.
A reminder that it was illegal to talk on a phone while driving an automobile. Bosch ignored him and took the call. It was Lieutenant Gandel.
"Harry, you close?"
"Getting off the 101.
"Good. I just wanted to give you a heads up. They're lining up at intake. Comb your hair."
"Got it. But maybe I'll give my partner the airtime."
Bosch glanced over at Chu, but didn't explain.
"Either way," Gandel said. "What's next?"
"He invoked, so we just book him. Then I have to go back to the war room and meet with the prosecutors. I've got questions."
"Harry, do they have this guy or not?"
Bosch checked Jessup in the mirror. He was back to looking out the window.
"I don't know, Lieutenant. When I know, you'll know."
A few minutes later, they pulled into the rear lot of the jail.
There were several television cameras and their operators lined up on a ramp leading to the intake door. Chu sat up straight.
Perp walk, Harry.
Yeah, you take him in.
Let's both do it.
Nah, I'll hang back.
You sure?
I'm sure. Just don't forget my cuffs.
Okay, Harry.
The lot was clogged with media vans, with their transmitters cranked to full height. But they had left the space in front of the ramp open. Bosch pulled in and parked.
Okay, you ready back there, Jessup?
Chu asked.
Time to sell tickets.
Jessup didn't respond. Chu opened the door and got out, then opened the rear door for Jessup. Bosch watched the ensuing spectacle from the confines of the car.
Chapter 5. Tuesday, February 16th, 4:14 p.m. One of the very best things about having previously been married to Maggie McPherson was that I never had to face her in court. The marital split created a conflict of interest that saved me professional defeat and humiliation at her hands on more than one occasion. She was truly the best prosecutor I'd ever seen step into the well, and they didn't call her Maggie McPherson for no reason. Now, for the first time, we would be on the same team in court, sitting side by side at the same table. But what had seemed like such a good idea, not to mention such a positive potential payoff for Maggie, was already manifesting itself as something jagged and rusty. Maggie was having issues with being second chair, and for good reason. She was a professional prosecutor. From drug dealers and petty thieves to rapists and murderers, she had put dozens of criminals behind bars. I had appeared in dozens of trials myself, but never as a prosecutor. Maggie would have to play backup to a novice, and that realization wasn't sitting well with her. We sat in conference room A, with the case files spread out before us on the big table. Though Williams had said I could run the case from my own independent office, the truth was, that wasn't practical at the moment. I didn't have an office outside my home. I primarily used the back seat of my Lincoln Town Car as my office, and that wouldn't do for the People versus Jason Jessup. I had my case manager setting up a temporary office in downtown, but we were at least a few days away from that. So temporarily, there we sat, eyes down and tensions up. Maggie, I said, when it comes to prosecuting bad guys, I will readily admit that I couldn't carry your lunch. But the thing is, when it comes to politics and prosecuting bad guys, the powers that be have put me in the first chair. That's the way it is, and we can either accept it or not. I took this job and asked for you. If you don't think we... I just don't like the idea of carrying your briefcase through this whole thing, Maggie said. You won't be. Look, press conferences and outward appearances are one thing, but I fully assume that we'll be working as a tag team. You'll be conducting just as much of the investigation as I will be, probably more. The trial should be no different. We'll come up with a strategy and choreograph it together, but you have to give me a little credit. I know my way around a courtroom. I'll just be sitting at the other table this time. That's where you're wrong, Mickey. On the defense side, you have a responsibility to one person, your client. When you're a prosecutor, you represent the people, and that is a lot more responsibility. That's why they call it the burden of proof. Whatever. If you're saying I shouldn't be doing this, then I'm not the guy you should be complaining to. Go down the hall and talk to your boss. But if he kicks me off the case, you get kicked as well, and then you go back to Van Nuys for the rest of your career. Is that what you want? She didn't answer, and that was an answer in itself. Okay, then, I said. Let's just try to get through this without pulling each other's hair out, okay? Remember, I'm not here to count convictions and advance my career. For me, it's one and done. So we both want the same thing. Yes, you will have to help me, but you will also be helping... My phone started vibrating. I had left it out on the table. I didn't recognize the number on the screen, but took the call, just to get away from the conversation with Maggie. Holler. Hey, Mick, how'd I do? Who is this? Styx. Styx was a freelance videographer who fed footage to the local news channels and sometimes even the bigs. I had known him so long, I didn't even remember his real name.
How'd you do it what, Sticks? I'm busy here.
At the press conference. I set you up, man.
I realized that it had been Sticks behind the lights, throwing the questions to me.
Oh, yeah, you did good. Thanks for that.
Now you're going to take care of me on the case, right? Give me the heads up if there's something for me, right? Something exclusive.
Yeah, no need to worry, Sticks. I got you covered, but I gotta go.
I ended the call and put the phone back on the table. Maggie was typing something into her laptop. It looked like the momentary discontent had passed, and I was hesitant to touch it again. That was a guy who works for the news stations. He might be useful to us at some point.
We don't want to do anything underhanded. The prosecution is held to a much higher standard of ethics than the defense.
I shook my head. I couldn't win. That's bullshit, and I'm not talking about doing anything un... The door opened, and Harry Bosch stepped in, pushing the door with his back because he was carrying two large boxes in his hands.
Sorry I'm late, he said.
He put the boxes down on the table. I could tell the larger one was a carton from Evidence Archives. I guessed that the smaller one contained the police file on the original investigation.
It took them 3 days to find the murder box. It was on the 85 aisle instead of 86.
He looked at me, and then at Maggie, and then back at me.
So what did I miss? War break out in the war room?
We were talking about prosecutorial tactics, and it turns out we have opposing views.
Imagine that.
He took the chair at the end of the table. I could tell he was going to have more to say. He lifted the top off the murder box and pulled out three accordion files and put them on the table. He then moved the box to the floor.
You know, Mick, while we're airing out our differences, I think before you pulled me into this little soap opera, you should have told me a few things up front.
Like what, Harry?
Like that this whole goddamn thing is about money and not murder.
What are you talking about? What money?
Bosch just stared at me without responding.
You're talking about Jessup's lawsuit? I asked.
That's right, he said. I had an interesting discussion with Jessup today on the drive down. Got me thinking, and it crossed my mind that if we jam this guy into a deal, the lawsuit against the city and county goes away, because a guy who admits to murder isn't going to be able to sue and claim he was railroaded. So I guess what I want to know is what we're really doing here. Are we trying to put a murder suspect on trial? Are we just trying to save the city and county a few million bucks?
I noticed Maggie's posture straighten as she considered the same thing.
You gotta be kidding me, she said. If that...
Hold on, I interjected. Let's be cool about this. I don't think that's the case here, okay? It's not that I haven't thought about it, but Williams didn't say one word about going for a dispo on this case. He told me to take it to trial. In fact, he assumes it will go to trial for the same reason you just mentioned. Jessup will never take a dispo for time served, or anything else, because there is no pot of gold in that. No book, no movie, no payout from the city. If he wants the money, he's got to go to trial and win. Maggie nodded her head slowly, as if weighing a valid supposition. Bosch didn't seem appeased at all.
But how would you know what Williams is up to? He asked. You're an outsider. They could have brought you in, wound you up, and pointed you in the right direction, and then sat back to watch you go.
He's right, Maggie added. Jessup doesn't even have a defense attorney. As soon as he does, he'll start talking deal.
I raised my hands in a calming gesture. Look at the press conference today. I threw out that we were going for the death penalty. I just did that to see how Williams would react. He didn't expect it, and afterward he pressed me in the hallway. He told me that it wasn't a decision I got to make. I told him it was just strategy, that I wanted Jessup to start thinking about a deal, and it gave Williams pause. He didn't see it. If he was thinking of a deal just to blow up the civil action, I would have been able to read it. I'm good at reading people. I could tell I still hadn't quite won Bosch over. Remember last year, with the two men from Hong Kong who wanted your ass on the next plane to China? I read them right and I played them right. In his eyes, I saw Bosch relent. That China story was a reminder that he owed me one, and I was collecting.
Okay, he said. So what do we do?
We assume Jessup's going to go to trial. As soon as he lawyers up, we'll know for sure. But we start preparing for it now, because if I was going to represent him, I would refuse to waive speedy trial. I would try to jam the prosecution on time to prepare and make the people put up or shut up. I check the date on my watch. If I'm right, that gives us 44 days till trial. We've got a lot of work to do between now and then. We looked at one another and sat in silence for a few moments before I threw the lead to Maggie. Maggie has spent the better part of the last week with the prosecution file on this. Harry, I know what you just brought in will have a lot of overlap, but why don't we start here by having Mags go through the cases presented at trial in 86? I think that will give us a good starting point of looking at what we need to do this time out. Bosch nodded his approval, and I signaled for Maggie to begin. She pulled her laptop over in front of her. Okay, a couple of basics first. Because it was a death penalty case, jury selection was the longest part of the trial, almost 3 weeks. The trial itself lasted 7 days, and then there were 3 days of deliberation on the initial verdicts. Then the death penalty phase went another 2 weeks. But 7 days of testimony and arguments, that to me is fast for a capital murder case. It was pretty cut and dried. And the defense? Well, there wasn't much of a defense. She looked at me as if I were responsible for the poor defense of the accused, even though I hadn't even gotten out of law school by 86. Who was his lawyer? I asked. Charles Bernard, she said. I checked with the California bar. He won't be handling the retrial. He's listed as deceased as of 94. The prosecutor, Gary Lintz, is also long gone. Don't remember either of them. Who is the judge? Walter Sackville. He's long retired, but I do remember him. He was tough. I had a few cases with him, Bosch added. He wouldn't take any shit from either side. Go on, I said. Okay, so the prosecution's story was this. The Landy family, that was our victim Melissa, who was 12, her 13-year-old sister Sarah, mother Regina, and stepfather Kensington lived on Windsor Boulevard in Hancock Park. The home was about a block north of Wilshire and in the vicinity of the Trinity United Church of God, which on Sundays back then drew about 6,000 people to its 2 morning services. People parked their cars all over Hancock Park to go to the church. That is, until the residents there got tired of their neighborhood being overrun every Sunday with traffic and parking issues and went to City Hall about it. They got the neighborhood turned into a residential parking zone during weekend hours. You had to have a sticker to park on the streets, including